I did check, and it is lot 61, that lot we were on, and I'm almost positive that it's right beside the baby grave that's there, the little baby.
Can we walk up there? Can we show him where it is?
We sure can.
I'm at the Mount Hope Cemetery in Franklin, Tennessee. I'm with a guy named Trey. We're both being led by the cemetery's groundskeeper to a grave, one that Trey has thought a lot about. As for the groundskeeper,
I've heard bits and pieces. The other gentleman that worked here that learned me the job out here was actually one of the firemen that was on the scene when it was all went down.
We arrive in what seems like a typical burial plot. That's when the caretaker points to a bare patch of grass.
I'm pretty sure that it's right here. You can see the sunk spot right here.
And that sunk spot is the only way to know there's a grave there at all. There's no marker. And when someone's buried without a gravestone, it's usually not a happy story. This is not a happy story.
How, when, where, why?
Of the murder itself? Okay, let's see.
This is Trey Holt. He's a therapist and an informal historian of sorts. His topic of choice, a murder that happened almost 70 years ago. It was December 11th, 1949.
Was it raining?
That's a good question.
I checked. It was raining in the small southern town of Franklin, Tennessee. An hour before midnight, a train pulled into the station. A woman got off in her late 20s. She had short brown hair and was wearing a coat with a large fur collar. Under that was a dress tucked into khaki riding pants, the kind that are tight at the ankles but billowy from the hips to the knees. She got off the train and convinced a man at the station to buy her a black market half pint of whiskey. With her newfound comfort in hand, she walked through the rain to a boarding house, one that was known for bootlegging and, well, all sorts of other vices. There were loud noises coming from inside. This woman was walking like she knew exactly where she was going. Several hours went by, and the sun came up. Across the street, a kid showed up to Franklin High School. She was early and noticed what she thought was a football practice dummy that had been left out in the rain. But when she looked closer, she realized it was something else. It was the woman with short brown hair lying face down in the mud. She was right next to the school's incinerator. And she was dead. Even though this murder was 70 years ago, Trey still thinks about it a lot. He's done research, he's written a historical fiction novel based around the murder, and is interested in the victim's grave.
My first question for you is, why do you care?
That's a complicated question. I don't like anything being left behind. And I think that this lady is somebody that has been, I guess, left behind. And I think that I have in some way felt it my mission to make sure she's not forever left behind.
I'm Jacob Lewis, and from Nashville Public Radio, you're listening to Neighbors, a show about what connects us. Today, we hear the story of a man who wants to give a victim the remembrance he thinks she deserves. When I first heard the story of this murder, a friend of mine told me that I had to talk to Trey. I went to his office, and since he's a therapist, I sat on his big, comfy couch next to a box of tissues to learn more.
I'm just going to test the levels. What did you have for breakfast today?
Coffee.
Not a breakfast man.
Nope.
Trey has long white hair, black glasses, wears Chuck Taylors, and has an earring. He looks more like a hippie Santa Claus than a guy who would be obsessed with a murder. But it really stuck when he was first told the story.
By my gym teacher in seventh grade.
Wait, so as a seventh grader, gym teacher's telling all the kids about this terrible murder.
And it was raining that day. And so we couldn't go outside. And so we were sitting, he told us this story. Because I think he had been a teacher at Franklin High School at the time it happened.
So sitting there in junior high, this story made its way into Trey's brain and stuck with him. And the thing that he connected with the most was the victim. That's because although Trey and his family are doing fine now, his mother's family wasn't very well off when she was growing up.
They were just very poor people and just had nothing. no social importance. And that's what it's always seemed to me that this lady had as well. Like, I don't even know how many people know she's there.
By there, Trey means the unmarked grave. It's in the back corner of the cemetery next to a Sonic drive-in. When police first found her lying by the high school, they flipped her over and discovered a few things. The most obvious, and brace yourselves, her head was nearly cut off. It was four deep cuts from ear to ear. Underneath her body was a copy of the Indianapolis Star newspaper. It was a couple months old. There was a partial drunk half pint of whiskey nearby, and in the pocket of her coat was a slip of paper. It had a name and address. Ike Beatty, 219 Russell Street. There was no city or state listed, which made it quite the mystery because there was no Russell Street in Franklin. No one by the name Ike Beatty either. It was a small town, so it was strange not to know who somebody was.
And this is probably one of the most bizarre turns of the whole story, was to put her out at the funeral home, hoping that somebody would be able to identify who she was.
More than 700 people showed up to see this woman. She had dark eyebrows, and one newspaper said her fingernails were nubby and grimy from work. And despite the very specific nature of her fingernails, no one had ever seen her before. Well, almost no one. Trey and I went down to where the old high school had been to get into the detective's frame of mind. Unfortunately, it was torn down just the week before.
So I don't know if they will run us off because they obviously have this fence up here.
I get run off all the time, so.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. We walk over to where the victim's body was found. It's next to some piles of knocked over bricks.
So the incinerator, it would have been somewhere just in this kind of vicinity.
There's really not much to see, but here's where it gets interesting. Trey points across the street, about a football field away.
That's where the boarding house would have been.
It was owned by a 60-year-old woman named Betty Burge. About a dozen people lived in her boarding house at any one time, and there were a few things that caused the police to go over there. First, it was close by. Why not ask them if they've heard anything? Second, police got reports of a, quote, wild drinking party there the night before. And third, the only other woman in town that had short brown hair and wore riding pants, like the victim had been wearing, was named Mary Ivy. She lived at the boarding house, so the police go over there to check on her.
Found out it wasn't Mary Ivy. She's alive. And also noticed that there was something strange about one of the windows in the boarding house, in the lobby. It had been cleaned. That was compared to the other window, I guess. It was on the same wall.
A detective walked over to this window and found blood in between the pane and the sash. There was some more in the cracks of the floorboards. And Betty assured him not to worry about this because her son Sherman
worked at a slaughterhouse.
Oh, so it could have been animal blood.
Could have been animal blood.
The detective continued to search the house. In a cabinet, he found a bloody pair of overalls. He saw that both Sherman and Betty had blood under their fingernails. Here was their first potential lead. In 1949, they could figure out if that blood was from an animal, like, say, a hog from a slaughterhouse, or a human. So the overalls were sent to Nashville. They were told they'd have the results the next day. Meanwhile, the police got a lead on the address in the victim's pocket, 219 Russell Street. A local reporter said he knew of an Isaac Beatty on a Russell Street in a town 60 miles away, Portland, Tennessee. The police showed up with a photograph of the victim. They showed it to Ike, which is short for Isaac, and the rest of his family.
And they knew who she was.
Her name was Rosa Mary Dean. Rosa was pretty much alone in life. Her husband had died in a car crash. She had twins. They had both died. Her parents were long gone. She was basically homeless, drifting from place to place. She met the Beattys when they were both living in Indianapolis. They tried to help her, give her some money, a job, a place to stay, a coat with a large fur collar, and some riding pants.
Evidently, from what I understand in my reading, she had come through Portland that night on the train.
That's because she wanted to see the Beatties. They had moved from Indianapolis to Portland. We don't know why she wanted to see them. What we do know is the Beatties weren't home. If they were, I might not be telling you this story right now. But they weren't. So Rosemary Dean rode the train onto Franklin. The question is, why Franklin? Well, this is where a crazy story gets even crazier. The police asked the Beatties if Rosemary Dean ever said anything that might be relevant to her murder. They said that she once told them if she ever needed money, she knew exactly where to get it. That's because going to that boarding house that night was not Rose's first encounter with Betty Birch. Let's go back another 5 years. Guess where Rosemary Dean was staying in 1944? Franklin. In fact, in Betty's boarding house. Rosa found out that Betty was having an affair with a married man in town named John Golden. Now, all you need to know about this is John wanted his wife out of the picture, so he told Betty that he would give her $100 and marry her if she helped him kill his wife. Betty got $50 in advance. John lured his wife out to a secluded spot in the woods. Betty held the woman while John beat her to death with his cane. Betty pushed the body into the Harpeth River. But, and here's the kicker, on the other side was Rosemary Dean watching the whole thing. John was convicted for the murder. During the investigation, he confessed. He even took police to the scene of the crime with Betty there and explained in graphic detail how Betty helped. He pointed out footprints in the mud that her shoes fit into perfectly. John's testimony was thrown out, though, because he was already a convicted felon. And Betty, she had around a dozen people at the boarding house who confirmed that she was taking care of her mother at the time. It seemed Betty got away with murder. So back to that night in 1949. It was a couple weeks before Christmas. It was raining. Rosemary Dean burst into Betty's boarding house demanding money, or else she was going to tell the police what she saw her and John Golden do that day across the river.
I mean, it's a good chance that's not going to end well.
Yeah. I mean, if they already have murdered somebody.
Right, exactly. And so I'm guessing she had to be pretty desperate.
And also, I'm just going to tell you this now. The police got the results from the blood test. It was from a human. What happened next to Rosa, we know because of a testimony from a man at the boarding house. He said he heard screaming and walked into a bedroom. He saw Rosa's body lying there in a puddle of blood. Sherman Burge was standing next to it. Betty was sitting in a rocking chair. The man said he asked Sherman what happened, and Sherman said, and I'm quoting here, "I killed her. This woman came up here demanding money of my mother, and she said she would go to the sheriff and tell him what she knew of the John Golden case." So Sherman sliced her throat several times from ear to ear. The police commented on the expert fashion in which the cuts were made. Then Sherman held a knife to this man's throat and forced him to help carry the body across the street. He told the man that if he ever told anyone, he would end up just like Rosemary Dean. It was a short trial. According to one newspaper, almost 15,000 people showed up. Only about 1,000 could fit into the courtroom. Betty Birch was the first woman in Tennessee to be sentenced to the electric chair. Although she never had that sentence carried out, the governor later commuted it to 99 years, Sherman's too. And Betty died of natural causes in prison. But shortly after she was convicted, Betty was escorted to her jail cell. She passed by the chamber of John Golden, the man who she once had an affair with and whose wife she helped kill, and he's reported to have muttered, "She had it coming." Okay, so we're going to take a little break, but when we come back, we're going to learn a little more about the grave of Rosemary Dean.
So you'll talk to him, but come here and I'll show you. And I'm going to tell you a little something.
Well, this story is associated with this building.
This is Mary Pierce. She's the executive director of the Heritage Foundation of Franklin and Williamson County. And she's really hospitable.
Can you think better with peach cobbler or a little piece of cheesecake?
We're in what is called the Old Old Jail. Apparently there's another building already called the Old Jail, so we're in the Old Old Jail. It was recently renovated to be the Heritage Foundation's offices.
So is this an original door, or is this put in here?
We did that.
Okay, gotcha.
It also happens to be where the Burges were first held before they went to the state penitentiary. There's an exhibit about the Burges next to a reproduction of a jail cell. And to me, it makes sense why. This is here for the same reason that there are ghost tours in southern mansions. It's exciting. It has a morbid draw. And this story is the perfect southern gothic tale. I mean, the Heritage Foundation had someone dress up and act like Betty Burge at one point. There's a little sandwich board with photos on it. Mary Pierce shows me one of several pictures of Betty.
This is Betty Burge leaving the courthouse with Sheriff Ewing Frazier. He is escorting
This is next to a police drawing of Rosemary Dean. It's kind of hard to get a sense of her. You know, short brown hair, dark eyebrows. I don't know what else to tell you. But it's also hard to think that this nice sketch had to imagine what Rosa would look like without her wounds. But here's what I find the most interesting. In all of my research, and Trey's too, it's the only image of her that we've ever seen. Trey has wrestled with the fact that there are people that, through circumstance, social standing, economics, whatever, they're viewed as if they don't matter as much as others.
I guess what I've eventually concluded is that if she doesn't matter, none of us matter.
So since Rose's family never claimed her body, and almost seven decades have passed, Trey has taken it upon himself to get her a headstone. There's just a little problem. No one really knows which grave is hers, including the caretaker of the cemetery.
My name's Jim Richardson. I've been the caretaker here now for about 23 years. Like I said, it's a nice place to work.
Trey chimes in.
It's a well-kept place. 3 out of 4 of my grandparents are here.
So from the records, Jim knows which lot Rosemary Dean is in, but a lot...
has 15 graves on it.
And this lot is unique. It's called Stranger's Row, or at least it used to be. Now it's called Single Row.
It was for transients or poor people who didn't have money to buy graves, and cemetery would give them a grave.
In Stranger's Row, there are several unmarked burial plots. The records of who is in those graves is kind of shoddy, so... they have to figure it out using a piece of metal called a sounding rod.
It's just a steel rod with a point on it with a T-handle.
So this is how this works. Jim goes to a sunk spot where he thinks a grave is and just sticks the rod into the ground. If there's no one buried there, the rod will go in the dirt a little bit and just kind of slow down as it gets deeper. If there's a nice vault and casket there...
it'll kind of be a thud.
But in the case of someone like Rosemary Dean... you'd get a different result.
People that were interned, that were poor or what have you, they were usually buried in pine boxes. And they don't last. I mean, 15, 20 years, you know, it's gone back to the earth.
So the sounding rod would have some initial resistance, and then it would just fall through into the void that was left by the casket and the body. It's not the most glamorous of methods, but it gets the job done. Trey says Jim deduced that Rosemary Dean's grave is in one of two spots.
Here or here. I mean, you know, we're within 3 foot of her.
Yeah, right. And we're gonna say here. I think because that's what you believe, and I believe you know more about it than anybody else. So.
I think all of this points to another question: why do some people get remembered and others don't? There are people all the time that die, and because they don't have a lot of money or social status, they're forgotten. And even though all these years Rosemary Dean hasn't been commemorated with the headstone, she ended up in the exact same place as the people that took her life. Literally. In Mount Hope Cemetery, you will find the graves of Betty and Sherman Burge.
Whatever you believe about whatever this is, or whatever is after this, or whatever came before this, everybody matters equally, no matter what we do. And I think it's so easy in our culture to shape our importance either by how much money we make or how big our house is or, you know, if we drive a Cadillac Escalade or whatever. I guess my foundational belief is we're all of equal importance. Yeah, even the people who do really bad stuff. None of us are free of having those parts too.
So Trey ordered a marker. Jim has to pour a foundation for it. And soon after the publishing of this episode, everyone will have a place to remember Rosa Mary Dean. Neighbors is from Nashville Public Radio and produced by me, Jacob Lewis, with production assistance from Bailey Robbins. This story was edited by Emily Siner, Mac Linebaugh, and Anita Bug. Music by Poddington Bear, and this song by Dan Burns. If you like Neighbors, I'd love it if you left a review in iTunes. I like reading them, and it helps other people find the show. Neighbors is a proud and founding member of The Herd, an audio collective of producers from all over the place. To learn more about all the shows in The Herd, visit theherdradio.com. That's H-E-A-R-D. Thanks for listening. I'm Jacob Lewis, and I'm reminding you to get to know your neighbors.